The unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch means it's Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? It's the coolest place on your dial because it's the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Houston Downtown, along with the absolutely undeniably indispensable Shannon McCurchy. You know, the 4th of July takes on a different flavor this year, one that follows events that smack of bitterness, followed by the bittersweet fusion served up by remorse. We've had to rethink our roles as human beings because at times we seem lifeless or at least unresponsive to hatred and injustice. And forget about the truth. However, the Declaration of Independence was written with the theory that every person has inherent rights, called self-evident truths. It reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." You've heard it all before, right? Well, more Americans than you think have no idea from where these words come. And in a little while, I'm going to share some data with you that will depress the hell out of you. But Harry Rubinstein, a curator of American politics at the Smithsonian Institute, says that Independence Day celebrates those very ideals of democracy, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and for is anyone who finds faith in the words, "All men are created equal." But he says it also is a holiday to remember and honor those first Americans who made sacrifices to create the Republic and then defend it over the years. Bravo, Mr. Rubinstein, and we aim to do just that with the help of tonight's guest teller, our very own KPFT Augie Augustine Gaona. Born in San Antonio in 1948, Augie experienced racism of the 50s and 60s. He graduated from high school in 1967 during the peak of the Vietnam era. He attended San Antonio College after graduation. Then he decided to enlist in the Air Force in 1970, and soon after that he got married. He stayed stateside for 4 years at Davis Monathon in Tucson. He came back home to San Antonio, worked in telecommunication off and on, then retired, and is now part of our KPF team. You're a fixture around here, aren't you, Augie?
Well,
you
people are. Tell me that.
And I just learned that you've never set foot in this stadium, in this studio. You've never been in front of a microphone. Shame on everyone, given the fact that you've got so much to say. And we are so glad that you're here. We're going to find out in a few minutes why you're a fixture here. And we're going to find out why you are so significant to the KPFT family. But first of all, give us a sense of the prejudice that you experienced growing up in San Antonio.
Well, when I was little, we had a house, four houses from the end of the block, but across the block was a black high school. Understand it was the only black high school in San Antonio, and so I saw the prejudice there of the black students not getting the good books and education. Yeah. But then we moved to another neighborhood, and I was in third grade in a new neighborhood, and I'm going to my elementary school. I would walk. And this old man in pajamas stepped out of his house, opened the screen door, asked me if I would run an errand for me, gave me a list of things he wanted, gave me some money, and said, "I'll keep the change." And that was the magic words, "keep the change."
Right, right.
So I rushed over there and to the store, and there was a lady in a really nice dress. I remember Leave It to Beaver, like she looked like June Cleaver.
Right, right.
And she was talking to some workmen. So I waited patiently thinking, okay, she's busy. But she noticed I wouldn't leave. So she changed her face, ugly face, and talked to me in uncertain terms to get out of there. As I ran out the door, I noticed a sign in the window saying, "We don't serve blacks, Mexicans, Indians, American Indians, Catholics, Jews, and dogs," I guess for emphasis.
Wow, yeah, an open-minded individual.
Right. So then I realized, real world.
Yeah. How did you respond to that?
Oh,
you were just a kid.
Yeah, I wanted the money. I knew there was another store in the corner I could go to. So
but that clearly made.
Yeah, but then I realized there were people like that.
Wow. You've got some great stories, Augie, and we're not going to be able to cover all the ones that I want to hear and that I know our listeners are going to want to hear. But let's talk a little bit about you and your dad and about your life and in the service, you shared with me that it was your friend's death that inspired you to enlist. Now, I know you're going to be talking about this a little bit more, but give us a sense of what that was about.
Yeah, I had studied military history because San Antonio is a military town and a lot of history there. So I was following the war, but to me it was exciting. And then I graduated from high school in 67 and went to college. And then all of a sudden, I'm seeing the news on TV, and as the years in college go on, I hear about more of my friends I graduated with, my classmates, are dying over there. And within about a year, like six or seven of them died, and I knew each one of those guys. And the last one was the one I was closest to. His name is Milton. And he was a special guy. He was smart. He was active, a lot of stuff. He's one of those people who say he's a special guy. He's going to be somebody. And he didn't have to go. His older brother went, so he wouldn't. But then his brother got wounded, and he enlisted, tried to go in the Navy, but the line was too long. He went to the Army recruiter, no waiting. And before long, he was in Vietnam, and he died over there and got the Medal of Honor posthumously. And because it was the peak, the bodies took a long time to come back stateside. But then I heard about his funeral and went to it, and he looked just like he had graduated from high school the last time I saw him, graduation, except he was in a green Army dress uniform, laid out in the casket with the top of his head all bandaged up, where a bullet had hit him. And it made me angry, and I thought, well, in a semester, I'm going to sign up.
What an image. What a narrative. Thank you. You know, the birth of a nation is about what Independence Day is, of course. But, you know, the 4th of July is about those who defended the Republic and rendered the ultimate sacrifice, like Milton. Your father was also this kind of a person. He was in Omaha. Tell us a story about your dad.
Well, my father's name is Dan. His father was a farmer who farmed other people's land, and he was a rover and took the family with him. He was good at it. I was told he bought a new car every year, and the children begged him to stay put and buy a house somewhere. My father dropped out of school around eighth grade so he could work full time, like a lot of other young boys did at that time. And he and his younger brother Frank were good at baseball, and he would sneak out of the house to play with a black baseball team in Louisiana. He was good enough. Baseball scouts wanted to sign him up, but he was too young to sign for himself, and his father declined, saying it was a kid's game and he should concentrate on working full time. World War II started and my father enlisted, I guess so his brothers wouldn't have to go. He ended up on a troop ship leaving England to go to France with a lot of other young men. He was there at D-Day and survived the battle and went on to fight at the Battle of the Bulge. His unit was overrun by the Germans, but he escaped and continued to fight, eventually getting frostbite in both his feet and being sent home. When he got stateside, the VA doctors wanted to cut his feet off. That's all he needed to hear, and got his clothes and hobbled out of the house, out of the hospital, and my mother took care of him. Every morning she would remove his bloody white cotton socks and wash them until his feet healed about a year later. Then he got a civil service job at Kelly Air Force Base in San Antonio and raised our family. My mother said when he came back from Europe, he threw away his uniform and was against war because of what he saw and experienced. I was born in 1948, the first of four children. San Antonio has a lot of military history, like I said, and I grew up reading much about it. I remember my father having many nightmares, and I didn't know why. He would also leave for his unit reunions every year. He had a strong bond with his comrades in arms. He liked to see war movies and documentaries, and I learned not to ask him any questions about them because he would get angry, and I couldn't figure out why either. So I read all I could about World War II and D-Day, and several books I read about a troop ship that got hit by a Navy ship during the night darkness, and it was pulled out of the column of ships going to France so it could be checked out at sunrise to assess the damage. It just had a dent, so it was returned to the column of ships going to battle. The spot they lost was with the group going in with the first wave. when they rejoined the column, they went in, with the group going into the seventh wave. I graduated in 1967, which was a bad year for young, healthy males. The Vietnam War was getting to its peak, and the military needed many young replacements. A lot of young men went to college to avoid the draft as long as they could. I went to college because I wanted to, and I was the first of my family to go. As my years in college progressed, like I said, I kept hearing about my classmates dying overseas, and I knew each one of them. And I, like I said, I was closest to the last one to die. He was smart and active in many school organizations. He got a scholarship to an East Coast college, and he was one of those guys you knew was going to be somebody special. His older brother, who graduated the year before us, enlisted so that his younger brother wouldn't have to go. Their parents died when they were young and had been raised by an elderly aunt. The older brother got wounded overseas, and my friend Milton got angry and decided to enlist. He wanted to go into the Navy, but the lines were too long at the Navy recruiter. But the Army recruiter next door had no lines, and he enlisted. He ended up going to Vietnam and earning the Medal of Honor posthumously, rescuing his buddies in a big ambush and knocking out two enemy machine guns. He attacked a third, and that was the one that got him. I forget when I heard about it, but there were so many dead it took a while for them to get home. I heard about his funeral and went to it. He looked just like he looked at graduation, which hadn't been too long before, except he was in a green army dress uniform and the top of his head was heavily bandaged where he had been hit. I got upset. It was a overcast, gray, rainy, sad day, and decided to enlist at the end of the semester. I went to an Air Force recruiter and signed up. I knew it was going to be a race between the Air Force and the draft board. There was a draft lottery that I guess a lot of people don't know about at that time. And I had a high number, which in most years I would have been safe and the number would not have been picked. But this year was different. Around Thanksgiving, I got orders to report for Air Force basic training. On my first or second day of basic training, my draft notice arrived at my parents' house. My mother got angry and called the draft board to tell them I was already in the military. When I finished boot camp and my father saw me in uniform, he had a different look about him. Later on, he could talk about World War II. He told me his ship was hit in the middle of the night by a Navy ship and were pulled out of the line and then put back in at sunrise when they saw there was not much damage to his ship. We were watching the beginning of the movie Saving Private Ryan when I asked him about D-Day. He said they were cramped in this small boat heading to a strange land. The water was very cold, they were scared, and many were seasick, and somebody was shooting at them. A very bad day. Thanks, Dad, for your service. And I found out why he acted the way he did. The nightmares, not wanting to tell me about what happened. But I was lucky staying stateside during my 4 years. It was a strategic air command base, because of some missile sites nearby, and I was in Strategic Air Command. But the main mission of the base was training F-4 fighter pilots for combat. They all went to battle from our base to battle over Vietnam. I almost went to Nam a couple times, but my commanding officer thought I was needed where I was at. It was a great experience, and I met some great people. Some of them were enlisted people with PhDs. They stayed in college as long as they could before they went into the military.
Thanks to your dad, indeed. What a great story, Augie. What a great story. And that really unfolded realistically, how you saw your dad. You saw your dad. You saw all of it, right? You heard the dialogue as that story unfolded.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 1972, I was given a low number. I got lucky, but yeah, that, boy. Yeah, when I tell people about that, about the draft or the configuration in those days, they don't get it. And when I tell people about Vietnam, my students, they think I might as well be talking about the Civil War, you know. It's like they don't realize how recent that is, really.
Oh, yeah.
In the great scheme of things. Wow. Wow. How do you feel? How do you feel after telling that story, Augie? How do you feel?
Oh, it's great to let people know about what went on back then. A lot of people don't know how it was.
Yeah. What's one thing you want listeners to know in particular? What's one thing you want them to know about your father?
Well, when I was young, I didn't appreciate him as much because he was kind of stern, because we had corporal punishment back then, spanking.
Yeah, well, he's your dad. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
You know, yeah, but
we don't get that.
But I knew he loved me anyway.
Yeah, of course.
And he was a great guy. He was a quiet guy. Yeah. Men back then were stoic. They didn't show their emotions. Mm-hmm. And I was like that, too.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until recently that I learned to get emotional and talk about
things. That's all right, man. That is okay, my friend. That's beautiful. Yeah, he loved you. And my God, you loved him, huh?
Yeah.
This is Hank Rubichek with Shannon McCurchy with guest teller Augie Gaona on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 in Livingston, or KPFT.org. If you're listening online, but whatever channel you took to get here, we are awfully, awfully glad that you are here. Now, you've been here at KPFT for a while.
Yeah, about what, 5 years.
40, 50, steady. 60 years? Oh, five
yeah,
years.
It feels okay. Like that, 60 yeah, sometimes.
Hey, listen, talk to me about it. I know. Now, I know that music kind of got you here, right?
Yeah,
great
it did.
Great story. Yeah. Tell us how your love for music played a part in getting you active in this crazy place.
Well, I moved from San Antonio to Houston because my company transferred me over here, and I liked music. I was raised up on rock and roll music. We had the second TV set on our block.
It's the only kind of music.
And we listened to American Bandstand, Dick Clark out of Philadelphia.
Oh, God.
And all the teenage girls would
I
come
give
over
it an eight.
To our house because we
eight.
Played American right. Bandstand. Mm-hmm. And I was a little boy with all these teenage girls, and my mom would show them how to bake brownies and cookies, and it was the best worlds.
Right.
Dessert and teenage girls.
Yeah. What were some of your favorite rock groups?
Oh, Bill Haley.
Billy and the Comets.
Yeah, and that's what I was.
Yeah.
And the Beatles and then.
Right.
The Byrds and a lot of other groups.
Oh, God, I wanted to be Dick Clark.
Yeah,
who didn't want to be Dick Clark?
Yeah.
I mean, all the girls were around him.
Oh, yeah.
He never aged.
I know.
He was pathetic. He was just one of these guys that you just couldn't. Shannon is over there saying, who in the world are you two talking about, right?
No, I've heard of them.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I have parents, too.
Fine. Okay, you have parents, too. Yeah.
I think she was looking her up on
that. That made you feel really good.
That's code for, I know old people, too, Hank. Yeah, I know old people, too.
No,
speaking of people around this crazy place, speaking with Shannon, her voice is going to room. Here's the only one who isn't crazy, Shannon McCurchy. Shannon, you know, guest teller Annie Garcia is going to be here next week, right?
Yes, sir.
And she's going to be returning.
Yes.
She was here during the fun drive.
Yes.
So we didn't get a
she
chance
told a
to
fantastic
hear.
Story about what got her and what the inspiration of mother's love for her child and how that inspired her to start a whole nonprofit and it's getting going off the ground at the moment.
Right. Now, we really don't know what she's going to be doing next week, but it's a non-miss show. I mean, they're all non-miss shows,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, she's a lawyer.
Tonight with Augie, this is a non-miss show.
Oh, God.
She's a lawyer, but don't say that because then people will want to miss her, but nevertheless, yeah.
No,
but she's
lawyers
one of
are
those
great
lawyers.
Storytellers.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Oh,
yeah, all right. Okay.
I'm going to tell all my lawyer friends
all right.
How you
yeah,
feel.
Yeah, like, okay, that's where I'm really worried. I won't sleep tonight. I will not sleep tonight. Now, listen, Shannon crafts our own out-of-sight Facebook page, posting everything that you need to know about storytelling and tellers, and a link to our very own new program site, www.sowhatsyourstory.info. And, well, you know, in life in general, we've got everything going on that. I talk about everything from soup to nuts, and mostly soup with a little bit of nuts, but we covered it all. So visit us often, please. Tell us what you're thinking, and make sure you like us when you leave on Facebook and our site. Just enjoy it, right?
Yes, sir. And, Hank, I want to remind our listeners that our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, meets the third Tuesday of the month every month from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Multi-Service Center. That's 1475 West Gray.
Thank you, Shannon. Now, look, here's something that I don't know if you folks are going to find this entertaining or what, but I have to say it because it's embarrassing. And we've got to do something. We've got to do something about what people know about our world. I'm an educator, so just be patient with me here. I know lots of smart kids. I just want to qualify that. And so many of them are my students. And many Americans, present company included, I'm talking Shannon, okay, know lots of history. But a lot of people don't. And what they don't know is beyond embarrassing. I'm emphasizing the word beyond. Based on a 2014 study by the Annenberg School of Communication, which is more credible than the Merits Poll and a bunch of other venues, of a cross-sample of Americans, 32.6%, are we ready, of Americans between the ages of 16 and 60, and that includes new citizens, have no idea why Independence Day is celebrated. I don't even want to ask what they think it is. All right. Oh, Day of Hot Dogs. I don't know. Of those who do, 19% couldn't circle its right date on the calendar. And when asked, from which country did America gain its independence? 14.7% named countries other than Britain. In descending order, they came up with France, Germany, Mexico, and check this one out, Canada. Yes, Canada. Those Canadians, boy. And before you laugh, just remember that, you know, Palin and Buckman both thought that our founding fathers wanted to free slaves, and Harvard-educated Senator Tom Cotton thinks, well, he doesn't think. And for the purpose of causing us serious despair, a whopping 64% of the entire sample could not name the three branches of government. I think they said Larry, Curly, and Moe. I believe somebody said that. I believe that included our governor, by the way. Okay, he had a memory lapse. Let's give him that. Yeah, okay. Well, most Americans used to know about history. Now only a full frontal assault on our educational system and a severe renovation of civics tests for those seeking citizenship can make a dent in our overwhelmingly national ignorance. It's tough to support what we don't understand. Thomas Paine said it best, those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom, must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Well, that's my story, and I'm definitely sticking to it, but we have to start thinking about that. You are listening to So What's Your Story with guest teller Augie Gaona, only on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston. Augie, who was the storyteller in your home growing up?
Well, I guess it was my father's dad, he was a rover. And
you knew your grandfather pretty well?
Well, no, because he was a rover, so I knew him toward the end. But he would take me and my brother down to the store and buy penny candy and comic books, however much you wanted. But he would tell me about his youth, riding down the I-10 trail to California on horseback and hitching up his horse to a cactus at the end of the day and putting on his bedroll at night and traveling. And so it was kind of neat for a boy.
How often did you see him?
Well, like I said, he rode, so we went from family to family around the country.
Right.
We'd see him like maybe once every couple of years. He had a lot of family, and he would stay.
And your dad never told you stories about the war, of course.
Oh, he never liked to talk about it.
When was it that you first asked him about?
Oh, when I was little, and I started reading books. I liked to. San Antonio was lucky. I was lucky to be there because there were a lot of bookstores, used bookstores in my neighborhood. And I'd always buy, started comic books and then paperback books about history. And then I saw my dad watching the movies, and I'm interested, so I'd be there with him and ask him questions, and he'd get angry and didn't understand why until much later.
I had a cousin who was killed in the war, and I was there when this happened, too, and his mother was devastated, as you might imagine, and when I was there, my mother and I were over her house, my aunt's house, and she gets a call from the draft board, right? And I don't know what they were talking about. I wasn't privy to the other person and what she was saying, but she was crying and she said something like, you know, you killed my son, something along that. And you heard her say, you heard this other woman, this other person over the other line, because she was yelling, saying, you know what, it's not my fault. And if your other son is in the war and he's killed, it's not my fault either. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're kind of smiling as if that's the kind of stuff that would happen. I don't know if that was the nature of the beast, but there was that level of lack of compassion, I guess, that I thought was really running rampant during that time. I think it was a combination of it being a really unpopular war, a war that wasn't understood, and a war that really wasn't talked about much.
Oh, yeah. There were a lot of strong feelings, like the older generation, younger generation, too, a lot of conflict and the older generation couldn't understand the way the younger generation.
Did you have conflict with the war?
At first, no. I was like everybody else. I felt I was educated where all our heroes were actually heroes, blue and white. You didn't know there were any faults with them until you learned about George Washington and all these others that they weren't perfect.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I really loved growing up was, you know, the sense of America and the sense that we, America was a bunch of, what was about, you know, core values. It was about the working class going to work. And I wanted to share this poem by Walt Whitman, I Hear America Singing, that I think is an interesting statement. I hear America singing the varied carols I hear, those of mechanics, each one singing his, as it should be, blithe and strong. The carpenter singing his as he measures his plank or beam, the mason singing his as he makes ready for work or leaves off work, the boatman singing what belongs to him in his boat, the deckhand singing on the steamboat deck, the shoemaker singing as he sits on his bench, the hatter singing in his stands, the woodcutter's song, the plowboy's on his way in the morning, the delicious singing of the mother or of the young wife at work, or of the young girl sewing or washing, each singing what belongs to him, to her, and to none else. The day what belongs to the day, at night the party of young fellows, robust, friendly, singing with open mouths their strong, melodious songs. Shannon and I want to wish everybody a very safe and fun 4th of July, because as William Faulkner demands, we must be free not because we claim freedom, but because we practice it. Thank you so much to you, Augie Gaona, for celebrating Independence Day with a salute to your father and by allowing us to appreciate the principles that really fuel your pride. You're a person who's terribly proud of him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like in music, they say the beat goes on, new yeah. generation comes up. My son, he's in his 19th year in the Coast Guard. And you wonder about our republic. And yeah. as long as these people, young folks, step up, defend a country, and help to make it a better country, right. I think we're in good hands.
You think we're going to get to that stage? Because we've got some problems.
Last Friday, I think we moved on to a better
yeah,
stage.
We really have, haven't we?
And
that was a good. It was a good.
And
week.
It's the younger generation that's helping to push that.
Yeah. How are you going to celebrate the 4th? Got any party plans?
No, I'm not sure. Probably watermelon and barbecue. And
right. Well, Catherine's out there, your wonderful friend. I mean, aren't you guys going to do anything fun?
Well, we always do.
We always do. Right. Spoken as a real man. I love it. Yeah. Hey, Scooter is up next with The Inner Side. To complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT, everybody make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, please join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. You keep loving a great story, and I'm going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. Till next week, I'm Dr. Hank, reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Remington College is urging people in the Houston area to donate blood at its upcoming Three Lives Blood Drive, a national effort to recruit minority blood donors and help supply local hospitals with blood. The effort has resulted in more than 12,000 pints of blood collected since the program began. That's enough blood to save more than 36,000 lives. Why focus on minority blood donors? According to the Sickle Cell Disease Association of America, African American donors provide blood with unique antigens that are vital for people with sickle cell disease, which affects 70,000 people in the U.S., as well as patients with other blood disorders. This event happens Tuesday, July 7th and Wednesday, July 8th. It's 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Tuesday and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Wednesday at the Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center, Remington College, Greens Point Campus, 11310.